Welcome, dear listeners, to today's session of Afternoon Satsang. And on this beautiful Holy Thursday, both myself and Prem are so excited to welcome you, because today's discussion, which is of course on the Conversations with Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba, the book written and authored by Dr. John Hislop, today's conversation has Swami revealing a beautiful incident. Usually we sit here and have satsang and we narrate Swami's experiences, miracles and incidents, and how, you know, in the multifarious ways Swami touches our lives. But here we have Swami narrating to Hislop a beautiful leela of his, and Swami narrates it so candidly and, if I can use the word, casually, as if it's like no big deal, but the incident is so beautiful, and that will probably be the highlight of today's afternoon satsang as well. So that is what we have lined up for you, and a lot of practical tips gets discussed today, you know, in terms of when we criticize others, what do we do, or in the case of meditation, so many practical tips. I'm not able to recollect, not because I'm not remembering it, but there are so many things that happened today. I think today will be one very happening afternoon satsang session, because this conversation that Swami has had with Hislop is so interesting, at least from our perspective here. I think Swami's teachings and message gets interesting for us at different degrees based on our own spiritual evolution and our own spiritual growth. So what is very exciting to some person may seem very natural and not so exciting to some others. But so from that perspective, yes, personally for me, it's a very, very exciting thing what we have lined up today. So we will be going to that. But before any of that, let us place our humble salutations at Bhagwan's lotus feet. And let us welcome Brother Prem. Sai Ram Prem.
Sai Ram Arvind, and Sai Ram to all our listeners. Yes, it's a very interesting discussion that we're going to have here. There have been occasions in the past, I think, sometimes in discourses, when Swami would narrate a beautiful incident which Swami was himself a part of. And one of those very sweet incidents is which we came across while going through some archival footage, when Swami was speaking, I think, in the institute auditorium or the hostel, where Swami was narrating a very simple incident, you know, but to think of Swami himself being thrilled by that and narrating it. Swami was saying that he had gone to one samiti somewhere in Chennai, and he was saying that that area had a water shortage and they did not have any well which was providing them water through the year. And the devotees in this particular area and the samiti came together and they said, we wanted to, you know, provide some relief to the people there. And Swami is narrating this. And you know what they did? They did a lot of bhajans and chanting Swami's name. They dug a well, and within a few feet they found fresh, sweet drinking water. So when Swami went to that place, they did a Purna Kumbham, where they carry that pot with water from that well, Swami said. Mm-hmm. And they invited Swami. You know, the thrill and joy of Swami narrating it. There are very few incidents where we've heard this, and as you rightly said, today Swami is going to narrate one incident. But before that, in a way, a beautiful precursor to that whole discussion is this conversation that Swami has been having with a scientist. We spoke about that even last week. And he hinted at something like, even Hislop also joined in and said that there are people who would like to study Swami's miracles under controlled environments. You know, that's how scientists usually come to believe in something, they said. The way Hislop was also putting it was like, you know, Swami, there's no question of us doubting you or anything, but won't it always help if, you know, you allow the critics to study it in their own way, and won't it convince them? I think that's a simple way in which we look. That, you know, it's so easy, you know, you let them study it and they'll find out. But we don't realize that how much faith is an important prerequisite for that. I was going through when Swami's talking about the scientists and all that, there was a scientist who had come to Swami in the 80s, a neuroscientist. And I think we have an article on him in the website too. He narrates that one incident, that how he was very skeptical about Swami in his student days. And then later many things happened. He got married to a devotee, and then he had his own experience and he changed. And he said that when he looks back at those days when he was very skeptical, he said it was very obvious that, you know, I had chosen not to believe. And I was reading with relish any critical article which was coming on Swami. And I was allowing that to cloud me further. He said, that's typically what we do. We have already chosen to believe, and we only want to look at such data which will bolster or add to the belief that we already have. And that happens so much even in our political views, even in our views about another person. It always happens like that. And that's why Swami clearly says, you know, if they want, let them come. And they see, they will transform. It is not for me to go and prove it to them. You know, that was the beautiful conversation that was happening.
See, when you say that, we usually seek views or read things or inundate ourselves with stuff that we are already biased towards. That is a criticism that people make even of the devotees. They say that you believe in Satya Sai Baba and therefore you are seeking out those instances, those experiences or those material which reinforce your belief and faith, and turning a blind eye to all the other thing that exists. This argument and debate can go on and on, but what you rightly said is faith is an important precursor for that experience to have its effect. I remember, I think I've narrated this multiple times, but in the college days, I also used to always think like this, that if at all Swami confers a miracle for anybody who comes to him, automatically they become devotees. Why is not Swami doing this? As this question was going on in my head, that evening when I walked into the audiovisual room, you know, I was part of the team that was maintaining the audiovisual systems there. So when I went into the audiovisual room, I found a book called Len Chimble's Dream. You know, it's after a lot of search that I finally managed to locate that book online. Unfortunately, it's out of print, but it was a very cartoon kind of book on the cover, and when I opened it, it was the imaginary conversation a man is having with God. And in that, though it's the conversation is imaginary, it was very profound, as I shall share. As I opened the book, the page that I landed on, in that Len, this man is asking God, God, why don't you do a miracle and, you know, make everybody your devotees? I said, wow, this is exactly what was going on in my head. And then God says, tell me, Len, what miracle do you want me to do? And Len says, do something magnificent, something grand, something which the whole world will notice. For instance, why don't you make this whole sky and ocean, some purple, pink, green, some color different from blue that, you know, everybody will know it's a miracle. And God says, Len, I don't think that will work, because somebody had once told me to make it blue. I did it, but now you've got explanations to explain why it is blue. So then God goes on to say that, if you have faith, you will see that you are able to breathe now when so many are unable to breathe now. Your heart is beating now when so many hearts are not beating now. It's a miracle. Every moment of your life is a miracle if you have that faith. If you don't have faith, even a miracle will become, you know, a coincidence, an unexplained scientific phenomenon maybe. Something like that. You will find some reason not to believe it. Now, even as this whole thing happened, I was looking at this incident and thinking, now, is this a coincidence that I get this question and I get the book to read it? Now, again, it's left to me. If I think that randomly this book happened to be there, it's a coincidence, that's one way. If I think that my Swami knows my heart, He knows everything that's going on, and He's there out of His love and grace, He's showering me with all that I need, this is nothing but another miracle, a small miracle, but a miracle that exactly when I have that question, when I'm ripe, I go and find this book which is lying in one corner in the room, and the first page I open happens to have the very same question with the answer. So, I think summing up what Swami answers there is the fact that when a person is approaching God with anything else other than faith and love, anything that God does will not be convincing enough. Even at that point in time, if one gets impacted, one goes back and in idle time, the mind takes over, the monkey mind plays tricks, and you start doubting the miracle that you have witnessed with your own eyes. And you think, probably I was sleepy, probably I didn't notice this, probably that happened. So you see, unless there is faith, whatever is done, you don't believe. Going by that, if they say that a scientist getting convinced is enough for everyone, for the scientific community to believe, if we look at history, there have been so many scientists who have been convinced of Bhagwan's divinity. And yet, what has happened because of that? It's not as if the scientific community accepted Bhagwan as God. they outcast those scientists who accepted Swami as God to be unscientific and to have become gullible or vulnerable. That is what happens. Therefore, there is no use of subjecting himself to these so-called controlled scientific experiments.
And the other thing with whatever Swami says or whatever Swami declares is, much of it is in the realm of the future, and the present is based on faith, right? You really don't see it. Many things which we've, you know, in our personal interactions with Swami, what Swami would have said or Swami would have declared in discourses, either you believe it or you don't believe it. There will be a time in future when it happens and you say that, yeah, Swami had said this before, right? And we've seen that with so many devotees. One of the old devotees from Mysore, she would say that, you know, when Swami had, we've spoken about her even in the Satyatusa series, Karunambaram Murthy.
Mm.
When Swami would visit their house in Mysore, Swami would look at the beautifully decked Mysore palace and say that, you know, it's so beautiful and I really love lights and flowers. And Swami said, in our Prashanti Nilayam, we'll put a lot of lights and flowers. And this was happening in mid-1940s, when there was no concept of Prashanti Nilayam in anyone's mind. You know, Swami was still in the Pathamandir. And Swami was talking about a grand day which was absolutely, you know, they couldn't even imagine at that point in time. Or Swami would sometimes, sitting in Chitravati, draw the map of Prashanti Nilayam. Right? And they asked Swami, what is this you're drawing? And Swami said, this is going to be the ashram in the future. And Swami said these words, this will be West Prashanti, this will be South Prashanti. And Swami said, this will be the North blocks where the foreigners will come and stay. And they said, Swami, people in Kottacharu are not coming to see you, and where are foreigners going to come and stay? You know, that is something that you can only see it in future. You either believe it or you don't believe it. So in that sense, it finally comes down to, you know, whether you accept what Swami is saying or not. And much of it cannot be explained or cannot be purely shown in that manner. But as we were saying, that the idea from where it is coming is probably not as skeptical. You know, it would be easier for Swami to put off the critics than each one of us going and explaining to all of these people. But we've seen that, you know, Swami, the same person who's the source of all these miracles, is also the source of the Maya so many times. He gives us space for that confusion too, and he gives the choice whether we want to choose the confusion or choose the clarity, and I think that is also part of the spiritual exercise.
The scientist asks, Baba does miracles to shake up disbelievers. And I think we went through this before, and Swami says, Baba does it for his own sake. Let the scientists come and I will transform them. The spiritual world is beyond the material. Material things are involved in sorrow. Do great scientists have compassion and a peaceful mind? No. They worry and worry. What is needed is to unite spiritual life and worldly life. Develop a spiritual life first and then live a spiritual life in the world. A dual life. Spiritual life is quality. Worldly life is quantity. So it's very clear that what we all seek in life is nothing but peace of mind, happiness, you know, just to feel fulfilled. And Swami is saying that by disbelieving or by fighting, if the scientist is able to achieve it, then fine. But you're not achieving it in that manner also. On the other hand, you see the people who have faith in God, who have possibly no scientific knowledge, they are peaceful and content. And it's almost like what we have that Telugu word, dishti, or nazar, buri nazar. You seem to be jealous and envious of them. You go and tell them you are fools to believe in God. They are peaceful, they are contented, they are happy. What is your problem? So Swami is saying, if by following science and being critical it is helping you to be peaceful, great. But it is not. So there is no use. Swami is saying spiritual life, a life of faith, a life of love for God is quality. Worldly life is only quantity. So, you know, it's like you may have a large quantity of something, but if that is a bad thing, it's bad for you. You have a large quantity of dung maybe, you know. Even cow dung is supposed to be so useful in many ways, but that's another discussion. So Swami is saying the quality of what you have in life is determined by your spirituality. And then the worldly life is the quantity of it, quantum of it. So you're focusing so much on the quantum of it and forgetting the quality part of it. Do you want to end up with so much of bad stuff? Or even a little bit of good stuff. A little bit of good is any day better than, you know, that's what Swami would say. A teaspoon of cow milk is better than barrels of donkey milk.
Right, and always this debate which Swami would often speak of, what spirituality offers versus what science offers. Putting it very simply, Swami would say that, you know, science can come up with the what and how, but the why is always with spirituality. At some point in time, you'll have to turn to spirituality for why. How is the sky blue and what makes it blue and all that you can explain with science. But why is something the way it is? Why am I going through life in this manner? Why there is suffering in the world? Science can never give you that purpose or the fundamental idea on which all of this is placed. And it's a very simple thing, you know. The most difficult experience we undergo can be, in a way, put up with if you have a reason to do that. The best example that Swami would give is, you know, the enormous pain that pregnancy and the delivery of a child brings to a mother. And Swami would say that that's a physical pain that is not comparable to any other regular mundane experience that we have. But still we have, you know, I don't know how many thousands and millions of mothers choose to give birth even today, I mean, on every single day, right? Which means you know that there is a purpose behind that pain and there is a joy behind that pain. And that purpose gives you so much of solace. And Swami would often say that the purpose behind life and purpose behind why you undergo a certain experience, for that you will have to turn to spirituality at some point in time. And that's why Swami says, if science can give you all the calmness, fine, why take it away from you? As most of the atheists would say, that they cannot take away from the fact that belief and faith gives so much of peace of mind to people. You know, they can debate, as they say, till the cows come home, but they cannot take away this fact that it gives so much of peace to people.
Going ahead, the scientist says, is it of value to let scientists test you? And Swami asks, what is the value? The scientist replies, if they can be convinced that the miracles are valid by scientific controls and standards, then belief in you will follow. And Swami says, if they believe, what will the world gain? Their worldly desires will increase since their understanding is so poor. The scientist says, it takes time. Science consolidates its gains only gradually. And Swami says, even they do not understand their own science fully enough. It is good that they go slow. You know, when it is said that, I'm just repeating what I said sometime back, that if a scientist accepting Swami as God is enough to prove to the fellow scientists, then possibly this method would have worked. But we have seen, whether it's Dr. Bhagwantam, our own professor, G. Venkatraman sir, you know, he has written very, very thought-provoking and powerful editorials also in some of India's leading newspapers, speaking about Swami and how, you know, which shows his conviction. In fact, when he speaks to us, he says that he was convinced that the only solution to world problems and India's problems lay in spirituality and not in science. That's why, though he is such a successful scientist, has authored more than 24 books, he turned to spirituality, and he has now authored spiritual books based on Swami's teachings. When he did that, there was a backlash from other scientists, other people in the scientific community, you know, calling him as vulnerable, gullible, who fell for a Baba's words or whatever like that. So that is not a standard method, and I think that is what Swami is trying to convey, that nothing is going to happen. And even if they believe, what will the world gain from that? It is not as if their belief will give the whole world belief. It is up to each individual. And that is the reason, you know, Swami is absolutely clear that there is no value in subjecting himself to any of these tests. In fact, you know, when we look at Swami's life, we realize that the miracle that we have seen documented and appreciate and share are just so few. Every moment of his life has been a miracle, and when we discover some things like that, one of the days about 3 years back, for the first time I saw one rare footage of one Dasara Yagnam, as all the priests are gathering around Swami. Swami picks up the bundle which he has to put it for the Purnahuti, quickly waves his hand, materializes about 4-5 diamonds and just puts it in the bag and puts the bundle into the Yagna Kunda. Among those 20 odd priests who are gathered around Swami, only one of them notices this, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why he stands on his toes and, you know, his eyes open up wide and he's like, wow, that's a miracle happening there. And we have noticed it because it has been captured on video. Now, I was just thinking, if you're going to do something like that, wouldn't it be awesome that you make everybody sit down, go on a grand pedestal, stand, and then do it. But that is not the reason, because Swami says, these miracles are my swabhava. It's just my nature. Just like you breathe and don't make a big deal about it, like that it is. So, Swami himself doesn't give so much importance to miracles, and it is natural that he dissuades anyone else also who are so focused on his miracles, forgetting the love and divinity aspect.
And I think later in today's discussion, Swami is going to say or hint at how most of these miracles as we see them are nothing but Swami's grace being elicited by devotees in a certain form. As the discussion will come, we'll come to that in a short while. But this conversation is still not complete. One of the visitors who is there is asking Swami this question. He says, is it not better to have a qualified nursemaid to care for a child when the mother is nervous and unable to give proper attention? So clearly it's a question out of the blue, not related to anything that's been discussed here. And Swami's reply to that is, the nursemaid gives love that is purchased. The mother's love is real. Give a child to servants and the child's thoughts are cultured at the servant's level. So that is Swami's answer to that. In fact, it's a very beautiful answer in a sense that Swami had, I think, said this in another discourse also, in a very similar context. Swami is talking about nurses taking care of children. Swami is saying that you could have the best nurse, right? But the best nurse will do the best nurse duty. She will never do the mother's duty. This is not to take away from the nature of the person, right? It's like saying that, you know, I could take a discourse of Swami and I can speak about it. I could be best at giving a commentary on Swami's discourse, but it is not Swami's discourse, right? It is secondary. I mean, I could be best at performing my duty, but a mother's duty is a mother's duty. A servant's duty is a servant's duty. So Swami is saying that what a mother gives cannot be, in that replicated, replaced by purchasing it. You know, if there is a situation where the mother is not there, the child is motherless, that's a completely different thing. But you cannot replace something as precious as mother's love with something like this. And when Swami says it'll only give the nature of the servant, again, it is not something that Swami is speaking low of anything like that. The mother's nature is completely different, you know, when you talk about the selflessness with which it is given. Yes, if the nursemaid has noble qualities, yes, those qualities will come.
No, in fact, the nursemaid, when Swami says that servant qualities, that servant may actually be an awesome mother for her own child at home.
Exactly.
But when she is now working as your servant, then those servant attributes will be displayed to the child. That's
right. Exactly.
In fact, because I remember, you know, the important word over here is gives love that is purchased. Because when somebody is being paid to take care of a child, it will definitely not selflessness. Though there will be some attachment, there will be some bonding. For that case, in that sense, you know, wherever we work also, we have some amount of attachment to our workplace. It's not as if that attachment has come because it is paid. All said and done, it's human nature to get attached, so there will be attachment, but it will not be like that of a mother. Unless it is spontaneous, it is not as if there are no such cases. In Swami's own life, Swami says there was Karanam Subbamma, who is like a second mother to Swami. So, and that was not purchased, and that was spontaneous, on her own. And so that's a different case altogether. But here, it's obvious that the way the question is being asked is most probably like, you know, in the modern times where both parents go to work, they employ a nursemaid to take care of the child, or both parents may not be going to work, they feel that it's too much of effort to take care of a child, so have a nursemaid to do most of the duties. So in such cases, Swami says, no, it can never replace a mother's love.
And I think it's also the idea of modern world, where we always look at professionalism for everything else. Mm-hmm. You know, rather than me driving a car, if there's somebody who's professional, you know, does that for a profession, you employ him, do that. Everything from sports to music to everything, you have that professionalism coming in. It's the question almost suggests that, you know, why not? Why should every person learn the art of taking care of a child? Mm. You know, somebody is professionally trained, let that person come do their duty, and then, you know, the child is 4 years old, can be partially be on her or his own. Then the mother steps in and, you know, takes on from there or whatever that is. that Swami is clearly stating that there are some things which are not meant to be given away like that. Right? And we're talking about professionalism. Swami would say this even about music. Swami would say it's a different thing when you have music as a means by which you communicate with God. It's a different thing when you have music as your profession. Right? It's a totally different way. And so, especially, you know, when you see the bhajan singers and all that, it's a different thing when that's a way by which you offer to Swami. That's, you know, you have your studies, you work in the hospital or you work in the university. But that is a different thing. That has got nothing to do with, as you're saying, it is not purchased, it is not monetizable, it is not transactable. It is only for offering to Swami. And a mother's love is like that when it comes spontaneously.
Then continuing with the spirit of asking random questions which are not connected to the theme. Another visitor says, Swami, the cement floor in my room is very, very hard. And Swami says, Baba instructs by life in the ashram. Up early and to bed early so that the mind is bright and alert. Live on the floor to learn that the body has few genuine needs. And even as I read this Swami's answer for the third or fourth time before this satsang, I again feel guilty. You know, so many things. Swami gives simple things to do. Sleep early, early to bed, early to rise. Simple things which I struggle to follow. It just humbles me and makes me realize the long journey that is yet to be traversed. And Swami says that by doing these things, you realize that the body has very few genuine needs. And instead of taking care of that, we start going behind the comforts and luxuries, and there's no end in that. If all your life you spend in pampering the body, where do you have time to think of the Atma, your true self? So that is the reason by which it's very Spartan. Now, anyway, speaking of which, I think it is the right time to also to say that things are changing right now in the ashram. Even as we speak, the old sheds that have existed for so many years are now being demolished in the ashram so that much more accommodation can come up. The ashram has faced a lot of accommodation crunch, especially during peak seasons, and it's expected that during the 95th birthday there will be a lot of rush, and one doesn't want the devotees shelling out large amounts of money looking for accommodation outside the ashram. So with that noble intent, this endeavor has been taken up and it's progressing quite fast. It's amazing. Beautiful double-decker and triple-decker sheds with lift and hot water facilities, I think, will be coming up very soon. And so life in the ashram is definitely getting better and better at taking care of the bodily needs. We can ensure that we should put in efforts to ensure that when we come to the ashram, our focus is only on our spiritual needs, because all other things by Bhagwan's grace is being taken care of.
Right, and Swami very clearly states here in that one statement, Baba instructs by life in the ashram. You know, this itself is an instruction. It's not about Swami telling in a discourse, Swami telling in the interview is a different thing. But merely by setting up the ashram and having certain things the way they are, Swami is instructing the things. And clearly, I think Swami has also said this, that and it is noticeable, you know, in our own lives, how our average level of need for comfort is actually on the rise. You know, there was a time when air condition was a luxury. But now it has really become a necessity in most of the cities, because the average lifestyle is improved, right? So the same level of you know, inconvenience that a hard cement floor has, this person is saying here, provided 30 years ago, I think with all the improved luxuries an ashram room can still provide the same inconvenience, because our minds have changed so much, our needs have changed so much. In fact, Swami also would say that, you know, with time things have to be improved. I've quoted this sometime back also, where once a devotee was protesting to Swami, a devotee was staying in the ashram. She went up to Swami and said, Swami, the ashram is changing so quickly. Too many conveniences are coming into the ashram. And Swami said, Em chese bangaru, what do I do? If this much also is not provided, people will not come. Then how do I transform people? Right? So Swami is saying that to a little extent, even I have to compromise. I would have loved to have still people sleeping under the trees. But then people should come, and a little bit of, a bait has to be given, and they will come, and then they will learn the ways of Swami. And the best part was, what was that lady referring to when she was saying the conveniences in the ashram? She was saying toilets and bathrooms being built inside the room. Because that was a time when they had common bathrooms. Even now, I think few of the old blocks, like the Patashala block, has that, you know, like a hostel kind of an accommodation. There's a common bathroom. So when Swami started putting bathrooms inside the rooms in the ashram, she said it's an extra luxury and convenience that Swami is providing. So you can imagine that how much it had to change with times, because our need for conveniences also had risen so much. So I think in that sense, the ashram is changing. But what Swami is saying is, this is again something which many of the people who had come to the ashram, even these days, one of my friends who had come from the United Kingdom, he was saying that he was staying here for a week or something. He was teaching in the university as a visiting faculty. He was saying, you know, when you come and stay in the ashram, that is when you realize that you actually need so less. As Swami is saying here, the need of convenience is very less. He's saying it's, one quarter of what I have on a regular basis in my house. Mm. But this is enough.
Mm.
When you live in so much luxury, you forget that this is all that it is required. You just need a decent place to lie down in, a clean place to live in, and place which has good air to breathe. That's all it is required. But we keep on piling luxuries, and in that process we forget, and we become dependent on all of these for a regular and happy life.
On that note, dear listeners, I think we will take a quick little break, because what is next is the beautiful story which we said, where Swami himself narrates what happened. And it happens on another occasion. I think it's a separate interview, because it starts with Hislop and an interpreter having breakfast with Swami. So that will follow after the break. Don't go anywhere. We'll see you very soon.
భాగ్యమో ఎంతటి సౌభాగ్యమో ఎంత భాగ్యమో ఎంతటి సౌభాగ్యమో భగవానుడు మన కోసం దిగి వచ్చాడు భగవానుడు మన కోసం దిగి వచ్చాడు భువిని సత్యసాయిగా నిలిచాడు భువన చక్రవర్తిగా నిలిచాడు భువిని సత్యసాయిగా వెలిచాడు భువన చక్రవర్తిగా నిలిచాడు ఎంత భాగ్యమో ఎంతటి సౌభాగ్యమో ఎంత భాగ్యమో ఎంతటి సౌభాగ్యమో రామ కథను విన్నాము రాముని ధ్యానించాము రామ కథను విన్నాము రాముని ధ్యానించాము రామా రామా శ్రీరామాని ఆర్తితో విలపించాము రామా శ్రీరామాని ఆర్తితో విలపించాము ధర్మమూర్తి శ్రీరాముడు దయచూపాడు ధర్మమూర్తి శ్రీరాముడు దయచూపాడు భువిని సత్యసాయిగా నిలిచాడు భువన చక్రవర్తిగా నిలిచాడు భువిని సత్యసాయిగా నిలిచాడు భువన చక్రవర్తిగా నిలిచాడు ఎంత భాగ్యమో ఎంతటి సౌభాగ్యమో ఎంత భాగ్యమో ఎంతటి సౌభాగ్యమో
గోపాల కృష్ణుని మా పాలి దేవుని, గోపాల కృష్ణుని మా పాలి దేవుని, కృష్ణ కృష్ణ శ్రీకృష్ణ అని గొంతెత్తి పిలిచాము, కృష్ణ శ్రీకృష్ణ అని గొంతెత్తి పిలిచాము, చల్లని మా నల్లనయ్య కరుణించాడు, చల్లని మా నల్లనయ్య కరుణించాడు, భువిని సత్య సాయిగా నిలిచాడు, భువన చక్రవర్తిగా నిలిచాడు, భువిని సత్య సాయిగా నిలిచాడు, భువన చక్రవర్తిగా నిలిచాడు. ఎంత భాగ్యమో ఎంతటి సౌభాగ్యమో, ఎంత భాగ్యమో ఎంతటి సౌభాగ్యమో, హృదయాంతరంగ సాయి శ్రీ సత్య సాయిని, హృదయాంతరంగ సాయి శ్రీ సత్య సాయిని, సాయి 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 శ్రీ సాయి అని భక్తితో ప్రార్థించాము, సాయి శ్రీ సాయి అని భక్తితో ప్రార్థించాము, వరదాభయ దివ్యమూర్తి వరమిచ్చాడు, వరదాభయ దివ్యమూర్తి వరమిచ్చాడు, కరుణారస దివ్య దృష్టి సారించాడు, ప్రేమామృత దివ్య వృష్టి కురిపించాడు, కరుణారస దివ్య దృష్టి సారించాడు, ప్రేమామృత దివ్య వృష్టి కురిపించాడు. ఎంత భాగ్యమో ఎంతటి సౌభాగ్యమో, ఎంత భాగ్యమో ఎంతటి సౌభాగ్యమో, భగవానుడు మన కోసం దిగి వచ్చాడు, భగవానుడు మన కోసం దిగి వచ్చాడు, భువిని సత్య సాయిగా నిలిచాడు, భువన చక్రవర్తిగా నిలిచాడు, భువిని సత్య సాయిగా నిలిచాడు, భువన చక్రవర్తిగా నిలిచాడు. ఎంత భాగ్యమో ఎంతటి సౌభాగ్యమో, ఎంత భాగ్యమో ఎంతటి సౌభాగ్యమో.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We were talking about the conversation that was happening between the scientists and Swami, those different questions which were being asked, and Swami was answering to all of that. And then two questions which were pretty much out of the syllabus, suddenly those questions were asked. But we are in that portion which we started off with. We said that we were going to talk about an incident that Swami himself narrates. The background for that, or how that whole thing happens, has been given in the conversations book itself by Hislop. He says, before he starts noting down the conversation verbatim, he says that Hislop and an interpreter were having breakfast with Swami. Two men, Mr. XY and Mr. CD, whose names have been changed, entered the room, and Mr. XY fell at Swami's feet. He was in tears, and it was obvious that some grave and sad errand had brought him to Swami. Hislop and his companion immediately left the room. Shortly, the two men left, and Baba called Hislop and the companion into his presence again. So this is the background for the entire conversation. Two people walk in when Hislop and Swami and a visitor are having breakfast. So seeing the situation, Hislop realizes that there must be something important and personal of nature between Swami, this devotee that he has come to discuss with Swami. So they leave Swami alone with this person, And thereafter Swami calls, and then Swami starts narrating as to what happened in that exchange.
And also, this must be the early 1980s, right? This conversation.
Possible.
So, by then, you know, Swami's interview room and mandir and all were well established. So, unless previously allowed, I don't think any random person could have walked in.
Right.
The very fact that they walked in like that must have indicated to Hislop that these are people whom Swami is definitely physically expecting. So, when they come back, you know, Swami himself whets their curiosity and says what has happened. He says, the case of Shri XY, so XY and CD are the two people, two men who came in, and Swami is speaking now of that. Swami says, the case of Shri XY will illustrate how Swami takes care of his devotees. When Sai's mother died, the summer course was on. Sai sent the body to Puttaparthi, but did not accompany it. His duty was the summer course. But at the XY house, there were only women and the body of Mrs. XY. So, XY is one of the gentlemen who had come, and it's evident that his wife has passed on. Nobody to take care, not even a priest to chant the required Vedic hymns. Swami drove directly from Prashanthi Nilayam to the XY house, taking a Vedic priest from the ashram in the car with him. Swami comforted the women, made all the needed arrangements before driving on to Vrindavan. Then he sent a senior man from the Vrindavan household to the house so that the ladies would not be alone in the house overnight. Sai is the close and real relative for all his devotees. The ladies of the XY household left their sorrow and all became happy with Sai's shower of grace. Now at this point in time, I'm sure that just as it arose in me to all others, listeners as well, the doubt will arise as to where was Mr. XY then when Mrs. XY passed away. So Swami says this much, that Mrs. XY just passed away and there were no men in the household. That's why Swami himself drove on his way from Puttaparthi to Vrindavan. He drove to the XY household, consoled them, and on reaching Vrindavan, sent a man, again who it is we don't know, sent him to take care of all the necessary things that had to be done at the XY household. And this much Swami reveals when Hislop asks, Swami was not told, but somehow he must have known when the lady died.
And then to that Swami replies, Swami knew well before the time of her death. He made all the necessary arrangements at that time, even sending a special message to Hislop on Tuesday the 16th that the college celebrations would not be held on the 25th, but not to tell the students. Mrs. XY was born on a full moon day and she died on a full moon day. So Swami says there that not only did he, did he respond after that incident happened, Swami knew it well before. In fact, Swami was preparing everybody without telling them that this was the reason. And then Hislop goes on to ask, why did she die? Was it that her time to die had arrived? And Swami's answer is very interesting. Swami says, her time to die arrived several years ago, but she prayed to Swami that before she died, she wanted to see her grandson married, and she wanted to witness the celebration of Swami's birthday. Swami granted her prayer. She also had a third desire, although she did not mention it. She had the desire that prior to her death, she would spend some days with her youngest son. When she was at Prashanthi Nilayam in November, she said to Swami that her grandson had married and that she was now witnessing Swami's birthday celebrations and that she was now content to die any time. Her major desire in the life had been fulfilled. Swami replied that if she died now, her husband, that is Mr. XY, who was abroad, would not be here. She said that Swami was here and that she was holding to him and to nobody else. Swami told her that she should go to the city of her youngest son and visit him for some days. And she did so. On December 18th, she was to return to her own house because her husband would arrive home from his trip abroad on December 19th. On the 18th, her son was driving her to the airport and she was talking to him from the back seat of the car. Then there was no further talk from her. She became silent. The son turned to look and saw her fallen on her side, she was gone.
One very interesting thing before we go ahead with the story is that Swami says that she told that she had two desires. And Swami says she also had a third desire, though she didn't say. You know, it makes us realize how redundant it is for us to express our desires to God. He knows the innermost recesses of our heart, and I think the moment a desire arises in the heart, He already knows it. So there is no need for us to actually tell. It emphasizes on us that every time we tell Swami something or we express our desire, we are doing it for our own satisfaction and our own, you know, to feel that we have asked or prayed to God, because Swami actually doesn't need it. And you know, the way the narration goes also, though she had expressed only two desires, that she wanted to see her grandson married and wanted to witness Swami's birthday celebrations, Swami says she had a third desire, that she wanted to spend some time with her youngest son. She didn't express it to me, and yet Swami fulfills it, because He Himself says, no, if you die now, your husband will have to come from abroad. Now you go and spend some time with your youngest son. So both the things, you know, Swami has solved, in a sense, the problem of her husband having to travel from abroad, and this wish that she wanted to spend time with her.
Right. And I think the other beautiful thing is when she says that she is not holding on to anyone else, she is holding only to Swami. I think her response was that, I am not keen that my husband should be there during my last moment or something. And I think that must have been such a genuine prayer. Swami arranged it in such a way that no inconvenience was caused to the husband, but at the same time, you know, she was not necessarily there, or her husband was not necessarily there when she was breathing her last. And I think that must have been a very genuine prayer that Swami accepted it.
It's very beautiful that this is the final thought before you die, actually. Because Swami says that the thoughts during your final moments are the thoughts that influence your next birth. So any unfulfilled desire, any anger that we are nursing within us, any hatred, any irritation, when I say a desire, I'm just not meaning a positive desire, a negative desire also. Anything that we nurse, that is what determines our next birth. Therefore, the ideal thoughts before our death should be that of God and nothing else, because there should be that feeling that I have nothing else, Swami, I want You. And usually that kind of thought is what liberates the soul. And when she is ready and having that kind of thought, Swami also decides that, you know, this is possibly the right time. This is definitely the right time before she possibly develops some other, because the mind's capacity to develop desire is so, what can I say, spontaneous and strong. It, at such a moment when it's ready and saying, no, I want nothing else, I want You only, Swami, it's beautiful that you are able to leave with that thought. So when Swami says that the son turned to look at her fallen on her side, she was gone. Hislop asks, without any pain? And Swami says, no pain, no suffering. She was in good health and was gone in an instant. The son turned the car and returned home. Had the mother died at the airport, the body would have been impounded. The son turned the car around on the highway and immediately drove home. When he got to the house, there was a phone call from Baba waiting for him. Baba had instructed one of the ashram officials to place the phone call with the message to send the body at once to the father's house. The ashram official was puzzled at the message, since he knew nothing about a body. Swami then phoned Mr. CD, the man who just now brought Mr. XY to Swami, and had him fly to Bombay to meet XY at the airport and bring him to Vrindavan. That was the occasion that you just now witnessed. Mr. CD was not to tell XY about the death of his wife until such time they were just about to arrive here. When you saw XY, he was overcome by the sudden news. The sequence of events was perfectly harmonized. When devotees surrender their lives to God and obey Him, He takes the full responsibility and cares for His devotee, even to the smallest detail. This is so, so beautiful, because you know the impact on a person when he hears that his spouse has passed away. So Swami sends a message first to the son, telling, possibly it looks like the son was at Bombay, going to the airport to pick up the father. Swami says, no, take your mother to your father's house. And that is possibly on the way from Puttaparthi to Bangalore, as was narrated earlier. So the son leaves with the body immediately from Bombay. In the meanwhile, Swami sends another person to go to Bombay to receive the husband and tells, get him straight to Vrindavan here, from into my presence. So that is another clue for us that this is happening in Vrindavan, not in Prashanthi Nilayam. And Swami tells the other man, CD, to get XY in his presence. And the beautiful, subtle thing that Swami does here is, tells him, don't tell about the passing of his wife when you meet him, but don't get him here without telling him also. Just before you come into my presence, tell it to him. So, you know, when you hear the news, you are devastated, you are shocked. And at that time, Swami is there to console. So beautiful it is. So, no wonder that Hislop saw XY walking in an absolutely abject state of sorrow. So, what must have happened when in his absence was that Swami would have consoled Mr. XY and given him all the divine love and grace. And Swami says here that when devotees surrender their lives to God and obey him, he takes full responsibility and cares for his devotee even to the smallest detail.
I think there are multiple points in this small narration of Swami, starting from the point that Swami said that her time was over long back. And, you know, she had desires and she said that, Swami, I would like to see these events before I conclude this earthly sojourn. And Swami was saying that, you know, yeah, fine, if that is your desire. The very fact that you have a Lord whom you can bargain for life like this, you can say that today I have to die, Swami, I need some more time, right? And it's not something new that we have to say, and it is a rhetoric, really, in that sense. He really has life and death in his hand, doesn't he? You know, a slightly more lighter incident than this, one of the teachers was once narrating, Swami had was walking for darshan once. There was an elderly lady, maybe in her 80s or even older. She got up to Swami and, you know, it looked like a conversation that was continuing from a previous conversation, and she was saying, Swami, please, Swami, please, Swami, permit me, Swami. And Swami was looking like he was bullying her, you know, no, I can't do anything, that sort of a thing. And you could make out the mischief in Swami's face. Then Swami, please, Swami, you can do it, and you can please permit me, and all that she was saying. And then Swami said, okay, I thought I'll at least give you a seat to somebody. Looks like I can't help it. And he walked away. And later Swami told the boys that apparently that lady was praying to Swami that, Swami, please permit me to see your 65th birthday and then go.
Hmm.
And Swami is saying, no, there is no time for you. And this lady is pleading with Swami, Swami, I don't know anything else. Just I want to live till I see Swami's 65th birthday. And then Swami was saying that, I thought I'll give you a seat to somebody else at least. But what to do? You're praying. Okay, have it. And, you know, that's precisely what happened. She lived to see Swami's birthday and then peacefully went away. And, I mean, it's a statement that need not be made to Swami's devotees, but yes, he's the one who has birth and death in his control completely. And that's one thing. And the point with Swami saying that, you know, when a devotee surrenders to Swami, he completely takes care. Probably not all devotees would have Swami physically doing this. You know, when I say physically, it's not within Swami's earthly lifetime when Swami did this. Now, how many devotees Swami must have done this of planning, you know, when the deceased person's body reaches and when this person comes and you send somebody to pick up. But we have all seen this kind of things falling miraculously into place, you know, almost like a puzzle forming itself so many times. And you will know that when you look back, you will think that how did all of this happen so perfectly? Especially at a time like this, when you're so, you know, pulled down by that emotion and you're not able to make decisions, you'll find that everything happens perfectly. The right time the person would have come, the right time the things would happen. You would not have been in a mental state to take decisions and make things happen. That is a clear sign that Swami is taking care of, you know, the situation. He's kind of, you know, like the elder of the family has come and taken charge. Mm. That's what would often happen in a large family. When there's a sudden demise of a person, you'll find that the elderly people will come and completely take charge of the household. They'll know, okay, this has to be done. I mean, to the extent of Swami saying there's nobody to chant mantra, so I took a priest from Prashanthi Nilayam. Right? And literally Swami taking charge like the elder of the family. And I'm sure that many, many devotees will have experiences like this. Not necessarily of the physical Swami, but that unseen hand coming and taking charge of everything.
You know, actually Swami adds one last point. When Swami reached the XY home after driving there from Prashanthi Nilayam, he arranged that the body be properly prepared and would remain so that XY drove home after seeing Baba and being comforted by him. Thus, by harmoniously relating all details, Swami even allowed XY to see the features of his wife and take the correct farewell. So beautifully orchestrated. Just reading this incident and, you know, playing it in our minds, it inspires us to actually just let go and let God. That's a very popular saying. They say, let go, let God. Just let God take care. You know, we won't face the stress and strain of having to make decisions. We go ahead with life with the full conviction that I do what my heart is saying. And if that is wrong, Swami will stop me. Swami will change the course of my action. If that is right, all things will fall in place. With that attitude, when we go ahead, when all things fall in place, we are happy. When all things don't fall in place also, we are happy because we were about to take a wrong step and Swami ensured that we don't take it. That's all it is. That's all it becomes finally. In either case, it is Swami's will that is prevailing, God's will that is, you know, taking charge of our life and things are happening. So whether what we have planned happens or what we have planned doesn't happen, we will rejoice because we will know it is in sync with God's plan. Again, for that, the basic requirement is we have faith and that kind of surrender to Swami.
Right. I think that's what Swami goes on to say after Hislop asked this question. He says, Swami, here just now we actually witnessed a part of this amazing story. How can all that be? Swami holds the entire universe in his hand. He bears the responsibility for the inconceivable, immense universe. And how can he at the same time give this detailed attention to the lives of individual devotees? And Swami says, it is as you say, Swami holds the universe in his hand. But devotees learn of the glory and majesty through Swami's attention to each one personally. That Swami holds the universe, yet at the same time fully cares for the lives of his devotees, even to the smallest detail, is a measure of his glory that the devotee can understand. In two sentences, I think probably Swami is describing the entire purpose of an avatar, right? As we have seen this many, many times. Yes, he is, as we all love to sing in our bhajans, Brahmandanayaka, right? And Swami would say the entire universe, and it may, in fact, the last week also we were talking, we have no comprehension of how large this universe is. If we really have the comprehension and we stand in front of Swami, I think we'll just faint to think that he is the master of that expansive universe. Right, and that is the immensity of this whole universe, and we look at Swami and we say Brahmandanayaka, but at the same time we are seeing the Swami doing this, coming down to that detail, coming down to that whatever you need, whatever is dear to you, I am here to address that. Right, and Swami clearly says that is the way by which you understand that God actually loves you. Right, it's very easy to think that God is the Supreme Lord, and the God is one who cares for everybody. But that idea that this is my Swami, as Swami would often say, that this Swami cares for me, that will come only when this kind of, you know, not necessarily for us, you know, when you're reading the story, we don't even know who that devotee is. You know, some X, Y, and C, D, we don't know who that person is. But you are seeing Swami's nature through the story. You know that Swami is there for you like this, even now, whichever time of the... if you want him to, he is there. It is a glimpse into Swami's nature, and that doesn't change. It's got nothing to do with... That's why it doesn't matter whether it's an XY or an AB or a CD. It is a glimpse into Swami's nature, and that nature is available for each one, whoever is there to crave for it. Right? And I think that's what Swami is saying. Yes, at the same time, I'm holding the universe in my hand, but at the same time, I can come down to that state and be your Swami too.
At that point, Hislop says, Swami, how is it that Swami makes a perfect harmony in one case, as with the death of Mrs. XY, and yet in another case, that of which we were speaking just before XY arrived, you know, I think this is not documented in the book, but he's saying the case which we were speaking before XY arrived, there is anything but harmony. Indeed, that's a highly imperfect situation. This is a big puzzle. So Swami, so Hislop is saying that in some devotees' life, there is such harmony falling in place, whereas in others it is not. Why is it like that? Though this is in, the question is in reply to Swami's reply that God takes care of the universe but is also doing for each individual. And Swami says, it depends on the people involved. In the case of a devotee who has pure thoughts and a pure heart and who has surrendered to Bhagwan, Swami takes full responsibility for that life and takes care of that devotee. But where a person has a big ego, relying on ego desire and not on Bhagwan, then Swami keeps at a distance and does not interfere. And Hislop says, oh, I see the difference. You know, as you pointed out how last week Swami shows how tiny we are, Swami says, in that world, in that continent, in that country, in that township, in that big house, one little individual, that's all. That's all it is. And how much big ego do you have? You know, Swami often has said that each individual is actually part, each vyashti is a part of the samashti or society. And society itself is a part of Srishti or nature. And Srishti is in itself just a part of God or Parameshti. As a Vyashti, we have so much ego and pride. You know, recently, of late, there has been this coronavirus pandemic, epidemic going on all around and everywhere, whether it's our news channels or the WhatsApp forwards, everywhere it's about the coronavirus. Among the plethora of forwards that I received one forward. I don't know if it is true. Just like many of the WhatsApp forwards, we don't know their authenticity. But the spirit was so beautiful, you know. It is supposed to have been written by a Chinese spiritual man. Whether that is not or true or not, what he writes is, the hustle and bustle of China has finally quieted down. The restless society has finally calmed down. The restless Chinese people have also calmed down. The wild animals that were held in cages have managed to keep humans in cages now. Humans have finally lowered their proud head and have begun to think quietly, are we the kings of earth? Mankind has felt the power of nature. And it goes on in this way. But you know, one tiny little thing and we are struck in awe and everything around the world seems to be going haywire. You know, travel bans are being put, all the opening up, globalization is all being shut back. You know, so much of changes which have not happened in 5 to 10 years have happened over 5 to 10 days. And suddenly, you know, everybody is saying, wow, this is the power of nature. What are we egoistic about? When Swami has beautifully given us a hierarchy, Vyashti, Samashti, Srishti, Parameshti. Samashti is so, so much more powerful than the Vyashti. Society is so much more powerful than the individual. And then, in the same hierarchy, nature, Srishti, is so, so much more powerful than society. It can affect societies in a trice like it is doing now. Then imagine the power of God. You know, once we realize that, despite our achievements, despite whatever we do, our head will always be bowed down in humility because we will feel gratitude for all that we are seeming to achieve. And at the same time, we will have our feet firmly planted in the ground, knowing that the biggest and the most grand achievement of mine is nothing but a small speck compared to the grandeur of the Lord.
And the point that Swami is making here, it's another very important one, where Swami says that Swami is there to take full responsibility for that life and takes care of the devotee who surrenders. But where a person has a big ego, relying on the ego desire, you know, and not on Bhagwan, Swami keeps a distance. It's a thing which I think in one of the Kode sessions Swami was telling when he was talking to students, in a very sweet manner and very matter-of-fact way Swami was putting it. And Swami was saying that, you know, you've seen this chapati, how they make chapati and dosa. Swami was making that action with his hand. How you turn, you know, how you flip the roti around. Swami said, I can transform you like that. In a trice, I can change you. Then Swami pauses and he says, but that is not Swami's nature. And on another occasion, apparently Swami was telling this to, I don't know whether students or devotees, one of the senior teachers was sharing this. He said, see, what we refer to as free will if you consider that you have free will, and Swami has given you that free will, right? God has given you that opportunity to take your own decisions. If you look at it that way, whether you want to be a spiritual person, you want to be a worldly person, you want to pursue arts, you want to pursue medicine, whatever, that choice has been given to you. So Swami says, Swami, I was telling that God will never interfere with that free will that has been gifted to you.
Mm.
I mean, it's so true. When you give somebody a gift, you've given it off. You should not, you know, keep tampering with that. But Swami went on to say that, see, I've given the free will. Now, if you want to give it to me, that is up to you now.
Mm.
And that is surrender. Swami says, when you give it to me, then you don't have to worry about anything. As Swami is saying here, I will take care of every small bit of your life after that. But I will not force you to give it to me. I will not take it away from you. You should be wise enough to say that, you know, what stupidity is this? I'm holding on to this. And you should willfully offer it to me and say, Swami, I surrender to you. And then Swami says, then it's a totally different, the equation is completely different. Right? Then it is like, as they say, the difference between an AMC and you having a service person come to you every now and then.
Hmm.
The kind of security and the kind of peace and the kind of headachelessness which comes with an AMC is completely different, right? An annual maintenance contract, if people are not familiar with that acronym. Then you don't have to worry, you just, that particular equipment is taken care of the way we do it even in our recording studio. That is what it is. Surrender is that. You're covered for life, as Swami is saying here. The whole process of spirituality is to make us make that conscious one decision that, Swami, I don't want this ego, I'm offering it to you. And I think that's what Swami is hinting at here, saying that to a devotee who has surrendered like that, this is what will happen, the incident that has just been witnessed.
And Swami adds on, he says, Swami can make the situation perfect in regard to the individual. But where there is big ego and the person wishes to follow the ego desire, Swami does not interfere. Allows the person to do as he wishes. What you right now just said, that free will is given to each individual to choose. And you can choose to say that, Swami, I don't want to choose anymore, you choose for me. Then Swami is fine, but as long as that's your choice. Then Hislop says, Swami tells us to cut the very roots of desire. What does cutting the roots mean? Swami says, if desire comes, analyze it. If it is good for you and not harmful to others, go ahead. If it is not good, put it aside at once. If you are uncertain, do nothing until the uncertainty is clarified. Wow, so precise, so clear cut. Then Hislop says, is it wrong to criticize a person? And Swami says, it is not wrong to criticize a person if the evaluation has been arrived at slowly and carefully. So, two very effective thumb rules Swami gives here. I think the first one is self-explanatory. Whenever you get any desire, analyze it. If it's good for you and not harmful to others, in line with help ever, hurt never, go ahead. If it's not good for you, or if it's good for you and it's harmful to others, don't go ahead. If you're not sure, wait till you get some clarity. So simple, that's it. Those are the three, two situations where you have to act and one situation where you have to just keep calm till you get clarity. So it's almost like Swami is saying, irrespective of what it is, don't act till you're clear. I think that's why it is often said, be clear, the rest will follow. And the second thing Swami says is, it's not wrong to criticize a person if you have evaluated it slowly and carefully. That's again important because usually when we criticize a person or gossip about a person, it's done at the spur of the moment, it's done instinctively, it's done because something that the other person said or did has upset me. It is not based on careful and detailed analysis. It is not a decision that I have arrived at after thinking along deeply. That's why Swami says, if the evaluation has been arrived at slowly and carefully, then it's okay. I'm reminded of that famous story where, from the biblical times, where everybody is wanting to stone a woman. I don't remember the details. And Jesus comes and says that, let the first person who is not a sinner cast the first stone, and then there's nobody to cast a stone. I also think that when we have to examine and dilate upon the fault of others, it is very important that we examine that fault is not there in us ourselves. Because even if we have gone through, you know, proper evaluation and arrived slowly at the mistake in the other person, me saying it will make no impact or effect because I myself am harboring that, you know. If I have the weakness of getting angry quickly, however right I am in my analysis that Prem is a person who gets angry quick, me telling it will not have any impact on Prem. It is better said by a person who has much better mastery over anger than me. Therefore, I think along with this, we should also ensure that the fault that we are pointing out in others should not be there in us. And in another context, Swami says that more often than not, the fault that we are finding in someone else is actually the fault that lies within us only, because there's nothing wrong in Srishti, it's all the problem in Drishti.
Also, these are two rules, like most of what Swami gives, you know, it kind of grows with you. When Swami says that you look at the desire and analyze, the way a spiritually mature person will look at a desire will be different from a way a worldly person will look at a desire. Going by what Swami has just said, he said it doesn't harm anybody else, it doesn't harm you. Actually, most of the bad desires and bad habits will fall under this category. It doesn't harm anybody. You know, I mean, it's my life, I'm doing it. But if following this, you will find that as you grow in maturity, the kind of desires you will keep away from also will keep changing. That's why it's a very beautiful technique that Swami is giving. It can be used by anyone. It can be used by a youngster who's got nothing, no knowledge of spirituality. It can even be used by a very spiritual person. When it is given to a spiritual person, he'll say that, does this desire add to my spiritual growth? Or is it necessary? Or will it pull me down? Will it tie me up in these, in the consequences of that desire? So in that sense, it's a very beautiful technique which will grow with you. And that's what I mean, saying so clearly, you know, just do this, that's enough. Which means it is going to take you to the state where, you know, starting from you get rid of desires which are absolutely bad and wrong for everybody, to desires which are probably noble, and as it will reach to the state where Swami would say ceiling on desires, finally it will take you to the state of desirelessness, which Swami says is the ultimate. Just the simple tool, it looks simple, but followed sincerely, it will take you to the last path. And I think the same thing even with criticizing others. Swami saying slowly and carefully analyze. I'm sure this slow, careful analyzation of whether a person is right or wrong will eventually take you to the point where, you know, there is nothing to criticize. You know, you will just say that, yes, this is a fault, or this is wrong in what that person said, but it's not worth criticizing. You know, it's the person is also in the path, he's also changing, or she's also transforming. So these are both are thumb rules in that sense, which will grow with you, with your maturity, the way you will criticize a person, as you rightly said. You will not criticize for the sake of criticism. You will look at constructive criticism, or you will look at what is the best way this is conveyed to that person so it benefits that person. So this will also change with the way you mature on the path.
I also think, like when you say how you mature and how mature you are, in a way it is related to my own self-concept, what I think of myself as. When I'm at the level of body identification, what I think is harmful for me will vary from when I'm looking at myself from an atmic standpoint. That's what is possibly the maturity that we gain along the path. Because, you know, when I think of smoking or drinking, even a person who smokes and drinks and loves to do it knows that it's harmful to him or her. And yet, they feel it's no problem doing this much harm or damage,
right,
for the sake of the pleasure that I get from that. But then one might ask, what is the harm in watching a movie? Going to a theater every week, it's giving me joy, it's not harming anybody else. I think that is where the maturity or the growth that you speak of comes in. Yes, depending on my spiritual evolution and maturity, at some point of time in my life, watching a movie is not harmful. But then when I grow a bit spiritually, when I realize that this life is meant for a purpose as high as this. It's like, you know, putting it in simple example, just before the final exams, what's wrong in watching a movie? It's not harming anybody, it's not harming me, right? But you know that your purpose in life is to get good marks in that examination, and therefore, though there is no harm that is happening to you in watching a movie before the exam, there's an opportunity cost that is coming wherein you feel that I could have as well spent that time studying so that I do better in my exam, so that it helps me better progress towards my goal faster. So, you know, expanding this analogy in life also, when we realize that life is one long drawn exam to which we need to pass in order to achieve a goal, we will start looking at any distractions from that goal as harmful to us, though it is not actually harming the body at that point in time. So that is what I meant by saying, when we mature in our self-concept, to stop considering ourselves just as bodies, to also considering ourselves as this mind and psychological combine, going ahead to consider ourselves as atmas that have rented out this body for a short period of time.
Yeah, absolutely. The very maturity that you look at your body as being gifted to you for a purpose. Mm-hmm. You know, from thinking that I am this body to I am residing in this body. And Swami would say, if somebody gives you, loans you even a piece of jewelry, the way you will care for it will be completely different from if you think that this is my jewelry. Right? So Swami says, with maturity, you will feel that this body has been loaned to you for a purpose. The way you will take care of it will be completely different. So the same habit of something like smoking or drinking, you would have thought when you were thinking that I am the body, that I am not harming anybody else. But with this maturity, you will think that I am harming something which has been loaned to me, and you will not do that.
I can feel that, you know, whenever, right now I have about 15 to 16 years of driving a car. Very, very confident of my abilities, and I feel I can drive anywhere. But even now when I'm driving somebody else's car, I'm a little tad bit more nervous than I'm driving my own car.
Right.
Because I just feel, my car, if I hit somewhere, no problem. But somebody, oh no, I better not, I have to be extra careful. Like you said, once we realize that this body is actually a temporary thing that has been given to us, we are, we are trustees of that body. The way we care for it will be different, and what we consider as harming ourselves will also change. On that note, dear listeners, I think
we'll, because the topic also changes at this point, and probably it's best to take it up next time. But given the situation that we're all in, as you rightly spoke about coronavirus and all that, yes, a tiny thing can disturb us so much. But as Swami is saying here, if you have surrendered yourself to me, the whole world cannot do anything to us. And I think that is the takeaway here. And if as Swami's devotees, we do not portray that fearlessness in our own lives, and I think it is an insult to Swami. I mean, to put it as crassly as that, because here we have the Lord who can change anything. You know, as Swami said, the whole universe is there in my hand.
Mm.
And what complexity is the human body compared to the complexity of this entire universe? And he is able to manage that. And I think we should completely be able to believe that Swami is in charge and there is nothing to worry. Yes, practically what has to be done. I think we are not saying that not to do that. That's part of our duty. Anything practical becomes part of our dharma that we have to perform. But there should be absolutely no reason for fear or anxiety in Swami's devotees in that sense.
So, praying that we always remember him, because just like Prem said, one tiny thing can cause so much fear. But Swami also says, one tiny thing, Sa-Yi, that's such a little name. That tiny thing can be a source of such fearlessness. So, as Prem said, while this doesn't mean that we don't take our practical measures, it just means that we don't get bogged down by fear. We live fearlessly, knowing fully well that our hands lie not in the hands of any doctor, not in the tentacles of any virus, but in the hands of our Lord, and His will be done always. On that note, dear listeners, we will conclude this satsang with a song, on the other side of which you will be greeted by Brother Chandu in his segment, Love to Love. We shall meet again next week to continue this beautiful conversations with Bhagwan Sri Sai Baba. Thank you. Jai Sai Ram.
साई मेरा तू है सहारा तू है सहारा साई मेरा तू है सहारा शिरडी अवतार परती पुरी भगवान अवतारा साई परती पुरी भगवान। ఎరడి అవతార సాయి వరతి పురి భగవాడి తుమ ప్రాణ సఖా ప్రభు
ప్రాణ సఖా ప్రభు
దీనో కే తుమ ప్రాణ సఖా ప్రభు
ప్రాణ సఖా ప్రభు
మేరే సాయిరా భగవా